Oakland artist Boots Riley is largely known for being the front man for the hip-hop group The Coup, and for his outspoken political activism. On July 6th, he officially adds filmmaker to his lengthy list of accomplishments, as his new movie, Sorry to Bother You, opens in select theaters. The movie, shot in Oakland, is an absurdist dark comedy with magical realism and science fiction. It centers around the character Cassius Green, a telemarketer who discovers a magical key to professional success, which propels him into a truly disturbing universe. The film stars Lakeith Stanfield, Tessa Thompson, Danny Glover, and Terry Crews, to name a few. Here's an excerpt from the movie's trailer.
I'm just out here surviving, and what I'm doing right now won't even matter.
Oh, baby, baby, it will always matter.
You said you fixed that.
Get a room. I got a
room. Hey, Cash, how much longer I gotta wait for my money?
God made this land for all of us. Greedy people like you want to hog it to yourself and your family. And
me and my family?
Yeah.
Cash, I'm your uncle.
I just really need a job.
This is telemarketing.
Stick to the script.
This is Cassius Green. Sorry to bother you. I just wanted to
You want to make some money here? Use your white voice.
My white voice.
Thank this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer. This is Langston from Regalview.
We go level it up!
You're going upstairs, my compadre.
Okay, bravo.
You don't have to sell out.
I'm not selling out.
Here's the starting salary.
Well, man, I'm going to have to get me some new suits.
I'm doing something I'm really good at.
Holla, holla, holla.
Cassius, the old you was way more interested.
You are rolling with the big dogs now.
Joining us to discuss his new movie, Sorry to Bother You, is hip-hop artist, activist, writer, and director, Boots Riley. So, Boots Riley, thank you for speaking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
So, how is this movie related at all to your 2012 album with the same title, Sorry to Bother You?
Well, I made that album after I wrote this script. Well, started it while I was writing the script. And the reason for the 2012 album was to get some buzz going about the screenplay so that I could hopefully get it made. And originally that was going to be the soundtrack to the film, but took a long time to get it made. So I knew that I had to make a new soundtrack, so we've made a totally new soundtrack. So we can call that one, that last one, inspired by the screenplay.
And so you've been working on the screenplay since 2012?
I finished it. I got to the end the first time in 2012, but I've been working on it since 2011.
And why did you decide to make this movie at this time?
Well, I didn't decide to make it at this time. I decided to make it back in 2011. I'm always pushing for ways to get ideas out. And that's where my art comes from. So I'm always looking for different ways. I mean, a few years ago, we did the Coup's Shadow Box at Yerba Buena, where we did a big multi-stage thing that was part theater and everything like that. I actually, in high school, at the same time as I was an organizer, I was involved in theater. My grandmother ran the Oakland Ensemble Theater in the 70s and 80s. And then I was part of the Black Repertory Group when they were, they're still based in Berkeley, but when they were right there on Alcatraz in a storefront that's now Alchemy Coffee Shop. And I wrote the school play, all that kind of stuff. And then I went to film school. And I was also doing music, and we got a record deal while I was in film school at San Francisco State, and quit that and did music. So, I don't know. It's always a different way to get ideas out and to talk about things. I mean, I guess that's what art is. Like when I started rapping, I didn't start rapping because I wanted a job. I started rapping because I wanted to create and have a way for people to talk about ideas. So there's nothing off limit.
So what are the similarities and differences between making music and film as forms of artistic expression?
You know, it's very similar in the sense that because I was the producer, or I am the producer in the coup, oftentimes I'll be in the studio and I might have the best bass player in the world and the drummer thinks he's the best drummer in the world, but probably isn't. And then the weird, crazy guitar player. And individually, they probably know more about music than I do. And they very surely know way more about their instrument than I do. But it's my job to get them to follow my vision. Not only follow my vision, but buy into it. Because if they were just following the vision because they were hired to do so, it would not come out well. So I have to be able to communicate with them and get them to see how they can fit into this overall vision, and communicate to them and know enough about that communication to know what will get them excited about it and what will get them to be able to put their passion into it. And I have to also know that the guitar player is always going to want a guitar solo and his guitar up louder, and that may not serve the overall vision. You know, I have to listen to it because they might be right, but I also have to know that they have their own biases and their own direction that they're coming from. And then on top of that, I have to know when to say, okay, to the bass player, that bass riff you're doing right there is way tighter than what I had. We're using that instead. So I have to attach my ego to the final project. You know, some people call that being humble, but it's not really that. It's attaching your ego to the final product as opposed to attaching your ego to the steps in between, because in the end, that's what it's about, is and getting everybody to attach their ego to the final product as opposed to the steps in between.
Well, you're talking a lot about the creative piece, but then there's also the piece about actually getting the film made. What was it like trying to get it produced? How were you able to get it produced?
Well, with this, you know, it was harder because what film investors do is they're making a bet. And so they want to make the most sure bet that they can. So that often is about, well, this thing worked before, so we know if we spend this much money on it, the odds are we'll make our money back, or we'll make money or whatever. And so the same thing keeps getting made over and over because of that. With my film, not only had I not made a film before, that was not the hardest part about it. You know, I co-directed one music video before. Matter of fact, we used your house, your apartment at the time.
I didn't know you co-directed that one. I didn't know that was co-directed by you. Okay.
Yeah.
Jesus the Pimp in the...
Me and Jesus the Pimp in the 79 Granada last night.
Right.
And then... having been to film school also, and then I also had done this weird little artsy short documentary. So, you know, there are a lot of people who start directing their first feature film that have only done a couple shorts or something like that. So, you know, I could talk my way around that part. But the part that was hard was adding that together with the fact that not only... It's not really even just about the politics of the movie, but the narrative structure of it is so different than what films normally do. So it, you know, it zigs where they say you're supposed to zag. I approach approached it more like a novel than a movie. Not in terms of length, but in terms of detail.
Right, which is why I was curious as to how you got folks to buy into that, because it's such a unique story.
Yeah, well, I think just to a certain extent, it worked on the page. And that's one part. But the other aspect is, you know, you can have that, but you can have this script and it can be good. But, you know, we all have very little time during the day, and all the people that could be helping out with it are also trying to hustle and do stuff. So they're picking and choosing what they're spending their hours during the day doing. And so to get someone to sit and read a 110-page script, you know, that's a big commitment, and they need to feel like it's going to be worth it. They're not just going to do it just like, you know, it's not like just listening to a song. It's 3 minutes, or maybe not even that, because if you don't like it, you'll turn it off after 10 seconds. It takes a second to figure out whether you like a script or not. So anyway, it's hard to get people to just read it in the first place. And I had met David Cross years and years ago at this concert that we did to raise money for an ambulance in Palestine. And I had his email address. So I hit him up, and he's, you know, even though it had been like 10 years before, he still had the same email, luckily. And he was like, yeah, sure. Just, I'll read it. Just send me a hard copy to my house. So I sent it to him. And what I learned later is that he had no intention of ever reading it. But he was on tour, and his assistant was house sitting. And his assistant was bored and happened to come right at the right time, and she opened it and read it. And when he got there, she was like, you have to read this. And so he read it, and he was like, yeah, use my name, whatever. So then I could be like, wow, okay, you know. And at the time, I also was adding on, look, cool, we're going to tour with it. Like, most indie films don't get that, you know, kind of promotion, but we'll do 40 cities, and we'll take the movie around and all that kind of stuff. So that was part of my pitch of, like, why it was a little bit more economically feasible than other films or whatever. But having David Cross saying, okay, I'm down with it, while it didn't move the needle as far as investors, it made other people think, okay, this might be funny. Let me read it. Got Patton Oswalt to read. So then I had David Cross and Patton Oswalt, and I could say that to people. Then I ran into Dave Eggers just on the street in San Francisco. And Dave Eggers is a writer. He's also the head of the publishing house McSweeney's, and he's written film scripts that have been produced and novels. So I was like, by this point, a couple years had gone past, and I thought maybe I'll just put this out on the internet so that, you know, it's at least known that I wrote it, and maybe 20 years from now somebody will read it and be like, wow, that was actually good, and, you know, who knows. So I ran into Dave, and I was like, hey, you know, could you read it and give me some notes? You know, and I had been getting notes before this, so, you know, just whoever would read it and getting ideas and all that kind of stuff. But I was like, give me some notes, because I want to make it as tight as possible. He read it and said what he publicly said later, which was that it's one of the best unproduced screenplays he's ever read. And he said, you got to let me put this out there for you, because everybody reads McSweeney's, and, you know, in the industry, it'll get known, you get some buzz going. So he did that. So then that's a huge cosign. Not only, obviously, like 10 or 20,000 people are reading it, because because it was packaged with the quarter. It was made into its own paperback book and then packaged with the quarterly. So a lot of people had it, and then it also just had this cosign of that where people were like, oh, this must be a good script. So it like moved to the top of the pile of interest for a lot of people.
And how did you get the names that you have on the movie project to be interested? Danny Glover, Lakeith.
Well, because now all of a sudden you have this screenplay that a lot of people are talking about as being good. Then you have other investors circling around it, and it's in my case is part of Sundance, so that makes actors more confident in it. Like, nobody wants to attach their name to something that might not get made, because then it makes that actor look bad. Like, oh, you know, they're trying to make this movie with so-and-so as the lead, but they couldn't get their money. Then it makes that actor's value in the marketplace seem like he's someone who people don't want to invest in. So actors are very often, actors that might have a name already would be worried about messing up that name, and so they wouldn't come on. But with this, it was something with all this buzz around it being a great script, and then folks circling it that were thinking about investing but were big names, like from, you know, Nina Yang Bon Jovi and Forrest Whitaker's company, Significant. You know, they were still, like, deciding whether it was, a good bet or not. And then, and then Charles King with Macro. So, you know, Nina Yang, Bon Jovi, and Forrest Whitaker, they had done Dope and Fruitvale Station and Roxanne. And so these folks were circling around it, and people in the industry talk, so managers and agents know, like, okay, this is a movie that might get made.
There seems to be a new wave of independent black directors, Jordan Peele with Get Out, Ana DuVernay, Selma 13, and even Birth of a Nation, and even to Ryan Coogler, Fruitvale Station, and then to Black Panther, which wasn't independent. But what do you attribute this new cycle of black-centered filmmaking to be, like, within the last 10 years?
Because there's a real movement happening that has nothing to do with film in any direct way. There's Black Lives Matter, and before that, Occupy, all these things dealing with real things and people in an uproar about it and trying to figure out how to change it. And often when that happens, that's when you get art that has some sort of response to it. And then doors open up where people are like, well, maybe we should make some movies thinking about this. Now, usually Hollywood is way behind the curve on this, you know, like 10 years behind. And then it's usually they pick folks that have the same viewpoint that all the other movies have already been showing. So I think in this case, for instance, with me, it's this movie's talking about the same stuff I've always been talking about. So, you know, it just happened to be that I already had this in the works, so it all lined up. And I think that's what's happening with this new wave of film directors is a direct response to what's happening outside the entertainment industry.
And what is the main point that you're trying to get across with this film?
That's the thing. That's not the way I make art necessarily. Like, I mean, obviously, there are strong, clear viewpoints in the movie, but like life, you know, I don't think there's one definition or reason to say, you know, that you could say your life is centered around. And I wanted to make a movie where you couldn't answer the question that you just asked, honestly. You know, where, you know, I can easily, you know, I'm good at taking a lot of ideas and crushing it down to one essence. But in this case, I'd be lying by omission.
A few main points? What are some main points?
I mean, everybody in the movie is trying to figure out a way to engage with the world. And looking for ways to make their life matter. And the main character, one of the things that he goes through is figuring out how to do that in one particular way and realizing that he needs that realizing that his engagement with the world relies a lot on everyone else.
And what's next for you, film-wise and career-wise?
Gonna write and direct more movies and even do a TV show. So
Boots Riley, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thank you.
That was hip-hop artist, activist, writer, and director Boots Riley talking about his new film, Sorry to Bother You, which debuts July 6th.